Okay, we should be recording now. So once again, it's great to have everybody here for our last regularly scheduled meeting of the semester. As I'll explain in just a moment, we might, I haven't decided what to do about office hours for later in the week. It depends a little bit on my own schedule, but also on how things go today. What I want to do today is really just talk a little bit about the course as a whole. I want to reflect back on some of the issues that we raised at the beginning and see if we think we've answered the questions well, if we've addressed the issues appropriately. If not, think about where we want to go next, what we think we ought to do in the future. But really, this isn't going to be certainly not a full-length formal lecture of any kind. I'll talk for just a little bit, but I want to spend most of our time today just having some open discussion, having some Q&A. It may be that we answer all of the questions that are on people's minds today, in which case it won't be necessary to have office hours on Thursday, though of course you can email me or call me anytime about anything. We will have an exam, a final exam that will be structured more or less like the midterm exam, though it might be a little bit longer. I'm still working on it, but maybe instead of answering four questions, you'll answer five or six, something like that. But it'll be the same kinds of questions, sort of short answer, essay type questions, designed to make you think a little bit, to make you think, and designed to sort of put together some of the things that we've talked about all semester long. Some synthesis, some integration, some review and reflection, kind of a little bit of what we're going to do today. So I'll have some more information about the exact logistics of the exam very soon, and it'll be the same kind of thing as before, where you'll have several days in which you can take it. So if you have schedule conflicts with travel or work or whatever, there will be a way for you to work around that. Okay. Yes, Bella, that's exactly right. But I've been working on a number of nefarious schemes to leverage these lectures for even more and more money. Maybe I'll just allow a teaser lecture or two to go onto YouTube, just to whet people's appetite, and they'll like what they see so much they'll easily be willing to pay, not $250, but $2,000 or $2,500 to see the rest. Who knows? Why don't we start just with a little bit of looking back on where we started, where we began at the beginning, at the start of the semester. One thing I always tell students in my regular classes is it's often useful at the very end of a course, the very end of a semester, to go back and reread some of the readings from the very beginning. Sometimes when you take, sometimes in any sort of college level class, the first week you get some introductory readings, overview readings. Sometimes they don't make a lot of sense, right? Sometimes they're too long, or the authors go into detail about some issues you don't really understand. You're not sure about the background and the context. It's not obvious why certain points are important. It's always a good idea at the end of the semester to go back and read some of those introductory articles again. Go back and look at them a second time. It's sort of like bookends. So you start and you end the term by looking at the same materials. And often it's very encouraging because, things that didn't make a lot of sense to you the first time around, now you get it, right? Now having done all the other reading and participated in all the other activities and listened to all the lectures and being in all the discussions and so on, now you kind of see where the professor was coming from, or where the authors of the articles at the beginning of the course were coming from. Now it starts to make sense. Now the pieces begin to come together. So I would urge you to go back and look at some of the readings from the very beginning of the course, and you might find them a lot more satisfactory or a lot more rewarding than you did the first time you read them. But with that, having said that, let's do the same thing in our discussion now. Go back and look again at some of the things we did at the very beginning. Now, you remember in the first week of the semester, I did my little bit of personal reflections. we were talking about the book, The Capitalist and the Entrepreneur, you know, the book that forms the heart of the material for this course. And in trying to explain why we decided to offer this course, I thought it would make sense to talk a little bit about why, you know, why I wrote the book. And as I explained then, for me personally, the book was all about, or the essays that constitute the book, are all about tying together two broad strands of my own personal research program, right? And so I work mainly in two areas, in Austrian economics more generally, in thinking about, reflecting on, writing about, pushing, expanding, extended, trying to make sense of the grand Austrian tradition that starts with Karl Menger, and is manifest in the great works of the 20th century Austrians, Mises, Hayek, Rothbard, Kirzner, and so on, and trying to think about Austrian methodology, the core concepts of Austrian economics, capital theory, time and uncertainty, the business cycle, market adjustment, and so on. So, while working on these topics, I've also spent a lot of my career thinking about applied issues in organizational economics, applied issues in the theory of the firm. And, you know, the essays in the book reflect my attempt to bring these two things together, to apply Austrian economics to issues of management, organization, strategy, corporate finance, governance, and so on, and also to use, to sort of develop or extend or advance the Austrian paradigm, informed by key issues in the theory of the firm, in the theories of organizations and markets. As we discussed at the very beginning, the Austrians are almost, not quite, but almost unique in giving the entrepreneur such an important role in their core economic theorizing, right? For many applied economists today, mainstream economists, mainstream management theorists, entrepreneurship is, sort of an applied topic that you might stick in at the end of the course, or maybe you might have a few specialized, sessions about. So just as economists have, you might take a course or read a book in the economics of labor unions, or the economics of international trade policy, or the economics of antitrust laws, or something like that, right? Likewise, to the mainstreamers, you might have a book or a lecture or a course or an article on the economics of entrepreneurship. In other words, for them, entrepreneurship is a phenomenon. In other words, it's startup companies, or it's the phenomenon of self-employment. And you take just sort of basic standard mainstream neoclassical economics or mainstream management theory, and you use it to study startups and self-employment, just as you would study labor unions or trade agreements or whatever. And that's, that's what the study of entrepreneurship is all about. For the Austrians and a few others, things are really different, right? Entrepreneurship is not just another phenomenon that you study with standard economics. Rather, entrepreneurship is a very general or basic attribute or aspect or function of how we think as human beings, how we act in the marketplace. And therefore, an entrepreneurial understanding of economics applies to all kinds of specialty fields, right? So one could have an entrepreneurial understanding of labor markets and labor unions, an entrepreneurial understanding of international trade, an entrepreneurial approach to antitrust laws, or whatever it might be. Okay? So for us, for the Austrians, and for us this semester, entrepreneurship is not just another mundane phenomenon that you study. Rather, it opens our eyes to a whole new way of thinking about economic organization. That's the, that's what I've been trying to persuade you about this semester. That's what I believe. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it. And I hope that I've persuaded you at least to take that perspective seriously, if not to, or even better, to embrace it completely. Right? As we think about Austrian economics and entrepreneurship, we realized that, there is no one Austrian theory of the entrepreneur. There is no one Austrian perspective on entrepreneurship. Now, you know, from time to time during our discussions this semester, it's been convenient, you know, we've sort of talked about the Austrian approach, you know, the Austrian perspective, really just kind of as a shorthand, right? Because we know from what we've read that, in fact, Mises' position is a little different from Hayek's. Kirzner's position is a little bit different from my own. Rothbard, Lachmann, other important Austrian economists have had slightly different things to say about entrepreneurs, about entrepreneurship. There's a variety of Austrian perspectives on the entrepreneur, but yet they all share this general view that entrepreneurship is not just a little technical specialty area to be pushed to the side when you don't need it, but rather that entrepreneurship is something basic and fundamental that pervades our entire understanding of the market process. You know, in the materials that we've read, in the issues that we've discussed, we've tried to show how application of Austrian economics, of Austrian perspectives, to managerial and organizational problems helps us to develop a new approach to the firm, right? What I call an entrepreneurial theory of the firm. And again, I don't want to claim that there is only one entrepreneurial theory of the firm, though I'm particularly enamored of the things that I've written about in the book and that we've discussed in other, you know, in other ways this semester. But, you know, one could think about applying other aspects of Austrian economics, other issues in the Austrian tradition to the theory of the firm and come up with a slightly different, perhaps complementary, Austrian approach to the firm. You know, I should mention, just as an aside, one of the chapters that we didn't discuss in great detail this semester, one of the chapters of my book, is the chapter that's called, the original title was The Mundane Economics of the Austrian School, but the title of the chapter in the book is The Price Theory in Austrian Economics. We didn't discuss that chapter in any detail. But, you know, if you're curious to give it a look, that chapter really has a little bit of a hidden agenda. That chapter is directed mainly at other students and scholars of Austrian economics, trying to persuade them that there is kind of a hard core of Austrian theory that deals with very ordinary subjects: production, resources, profit, entrepreneurship, that it sometimes gets neglected in some modern treatments of the Austrian school. So some of you, those of you who have already studied a lot of Austrian writings, who have read a lot in contemporary Austrian literature, might have noticed that this course has a little bit of a different flavor. It's hard to describe or characterize exactly. This is kind of blue-collar Austrian economics as opposed to fancy Austrian economics. Or this is what I call mundane Austrian economics as opposed to sort of exotic Austrian economics. What do I mean? Well, if you read the contemporary Austrian literature, sometimes you get the impression that the sum total of Austrian economics, or the most important issue in Austrian economics, is spontaneous order, or evolution, or unintended consequences. That really Austrian economics is simply the study of subjectivism, radical subjectivism. That Austrians really care about not so much sort of plain vanilla economic topics about resource allocation, but in the theory of the mind and how the mind and the market work together. In more philosophical topics, sort of interpretation and meaning, hermeneutics, evolution, spontaneity, cognition, etc. I mean, look, those things have come up from time to time. I certainly, they're important. I would never deny that they're important. But to me, those issues are kind of on the fringe. Those are not the hardcore issues in the Austrian tradition. But not all Austrians would agree. If you read that chapter on price theory in Austrian economics, I summarize some other treatments of the Austrian tradition that one finds in the Austrian literature, like, for example, Karen Vaughan's 1994 book, Austrian Economics in America. I have a somewhat different interpretation from Karen Vaughan on the significance of, or the importance of, or the key elements of the Austrian tradition. I don't think spontaneous order and subjectivism and evolution and cognition and so on are really the critical issues in the Austrian tradition. You know, again, we mentioned them from time to time. We talked about spontaneous order when we discussed institutions, but my approach is, again, a little more plain vanilla. You know, I call it a causal realist approach, rooted more in Menger's price theory and giving a lot more attention to Rothbard, for example, than what you get in some of the some other contemporary Austrian treatments. My point in bringing all this up is not to suggest, you know, not to try to you know, stir up trouble or controversy among Austrians, my reason for telling you now, but just to point out that Austrian economics is not a monolith. Right? There are a variety of Austrian perspectives on any issue. Austrian economics is not completely uniform. Okay? And the perspective that I've emphasized is, again, this causal realist, what I think of sort of a blue-collar approach. So, you know, recognize that. Be aware of it. You may be attracted to other approaches within the Austrian tradition, and that's fine. But it's just helpful to know where everybody is coming from. Okay? Now, more specifically, you know, my hidden agenda in writing the book is to advocate kind of a new approach to a new approach to economic organization, a new theory of the firm, a new theory of management, a new theory of firm strategy. And, you know, I've found in the last few years that mainstream scholars in management and strategy and organization are surprisingly open to new approaches, to this new approach in particular. So, you know, maybe we'll make some headway in developing a whole new approach to the organization. Remember, at the beginning of our course, we said, what exactly is entrepreneurship anyway? Is it a person? Is it a kind of firm? Or is it a behavior? Right? And I hope that I've convinced you that while, you know, people who start their own firms, people who work for themselves, do act entrepreneurially, and while startup companies are one kind of manifestation of entrepreneurship, that entrepreneurship is much more than just self-employment or just startups. It's a behavior or a function or an attribute that's manifest in many, many different kinds of activities. You know, is it something that can be measured? Again, if you define it as just self-employment and startups, well, we can measure those. If we define it as R&D or venture capital or patents or new products, well, those are things we can at least try to measure as well. And again, I'm not discounting the importance of any of those things, but I do want to remind you that, you know, the entrepreneurial way of thinking, the entrepreneurial aspect of human behavior, you know, is more than just things that we can measure, like you know, these kinds of things that can be measured. So empirical research papers that try to count these things, that try to measure these things and use them to say how much entrepreneurship there is in country A as opposed to country B, or how much entrepreneurship there is now as opposed to some period in the past. You know, you have to take those with a grain of salt. I mean, they're getting at something, but they're not capturing entrepreneurship in the broadest sense, okay? And, you know, all the policymakers who say we ought to have more self-employment and more startups and more R&D and more VC and more patents and more new products and so on, well, again, I think we want to evaluate those claims with some care and some caution, right? We tend to look at those things, and policymakers try to stimulate those things because they are the things that you can measure. You remember the drunk looking for his keys under the lamppost. You know, but as we saw, entrepreneurial behavior is not necessarily value creating, right? Employees who are, you know, in creative and innovative ways, coming up with new ways to waste time on the job. Politicians coming up with new ways to extract more tax revenue. You know, other actors who are alert to opportunities to maybe enrich themselves while inflicting great harm on other people in the firm or in society, you know, are not necessarily creating, not necessarily making the world a better place. So I think we want to be judicious in how we think about some entrepreneurship policy, okay? Some entrepreneurship might be destructive as opposed to productive, okay? Remember these questions we asked on the first day of our meeting? Can entrepreneurial ideas, discoveries, judgment, etc. be traded in markets? Do entrepreneurs need firms to realize their visions? Well, I've argued, and I hope have persuaded you, that entrepreneurship and the firm are intrinsically linked. That the business firm is the main arena in which entrepreneurship is exercised. And that while individuals can be creative, while individuals can scan the horizon and be alert to opportunities, they aren't really acting as entrepreneurs unless they have resources at stake. Excuse me. As Frank Knight argued, judgment, meaning decisions about how resources will be deployed under conditions of uncertainty, is not something that can be traded in markets. To exercise judgment, to be a capitalist entrepreneur in Mises' sense, requires ownership of resources. It requires having a firm. Okay? That's the Knightian explanation for why firms exist, is because entrepreneurs need firms to realize their visions. Okay? How can firms stimulate entrepreneur-ish or entrepreneur-like behavior? In other words, can they get their delegates, their proxy entrepreneurs, as we call them, to create value, to make good decisions about how resources ought to be used? Does this necessarily create value? Well, we looked at some organizational design issues and showed how by providing proper incentives, with appropriate schemes for monitoring and so on, entrepreneurs, capitalist entrepreneurs, can try to stimulate value-creating sort of, pseudo-entrepreneurial or proxy-entrepreneurial behavior among individuals within the firm. But that some of that behavior can be value-destroying and needs to be governed and incentivized very, very carefully. How do firms organize themselves for innovation? We mentioned this briefly. We didn't touch on this question as much, because we ran out of time, really, before we could go into a lot of detail on Joseph Schumpeter and Schumpeter's theory of the innovating entrepreneur, right? But we saw that when firms have sort of appropriate mechanisms for incentives and delegation and so on, they can stimulate innovation and that kind of creativity among employees. We talked a lot about entrepreneurship in non-market settings. Daniel is asking in the chat window about social entrepreneurship. We touched on it a little bit, but we didn't spend a whole lot of time in detail. We talked a little bit more about political entrepreneurship or policy entrepreneurship. So entrepreneurship in a non-market setting is in many ways a different thing. We pointed out that many of the concepts from entrepreneurship theory, creativity, alertness, judgment, innovation, and so on, they can be ported over to non-market settings, so-called social entrepreneurs, or public or political entrepreneurs, but with some important caveats, right? That gains and losses are difficult to measure. The social entrepreneur or the political entrepreneur, the non-market entrepreneur, does not have access to the tools of economic calculation in the same way as the for-profit market entrepreneur. And there isn't the same selection mechanism to distinguish good and poor entrepreneurs and to direct more resources towards the former and away from the latter. So again, we saw that there was some, the analogy can provide some insight when we apply entrepreneurship concepts to a non-market setting, but it only goes so far. And we have to be very careful not to misuse these concepts, this language, and trying to act as if politicians are entrepreneurs in the same positive sense as market entrepreneurs. Now, I was looking at my conclusion slide from lecture one, and it looked something like the following. I said, entrepreneurship is not just a specialized field in economics or management, like the economics of labor unions, right? But it is at the heart of the capitalist economy. The capitalist economy is an entrepreneurial economy because we live in a world of uncertainty, and the ultimate decisions in a market economy are those about how capital resources will be used, how the economy's productive resources will be devoted to or dedicated to one activity or another, one firm or another, one line of production or another. That's what the entrepreneur does. I claim that the mainstream literature on entrepreneurship has difficulty integrating entrepreneurship into more general theories of organizations and markets. And I hope you've been exposed to enough of that mainstream literature by now to find this a reasonably acceptable statement. I claim that Austrian economics has a lot to contribute to the theory of markets and prices, to the theory of the firm, to business practice, and to various policy issues, regulation, antitrust, bailouts, subsidies, macro policy, and more. Did I convince you? Well, I don't know. We'll find out when we have some discussion in just a moment here. I hope that I did, but as I said before, that's my story and I'm sticking to it. Now, what do we do next? Right? Where do we go from here? And I mean that in several ways. For each of us as individuals thinking about these issues, for those of you who are going on to further study in entrepreneurship or business administration or other parts of Austrian economics, hoping to build on these concepts, to think about them more, maybe to write and research, to research them, to write about them. Or those of you who are practitioners, is any of this stuff useful to you? Well, let's think about those kind of one at a time. Let's think about these next steps. You get it? The little stepping stones? Those are next steps. At least they are according to the Clipart website where I stole that. What are some implications for theory, for Austrian economic theory, for the theory of the entrepreneur? Well, again, you know, you can think about this in a couple of different ways, right? We could sort of look inward in the sense of saying, what have we learned about the Austrian paradigm that we can carry forward? Right, so have we learned anything about how markets operate? Factor markets, for example, and consumer goods markets, output markets. Have we learned anything from our study of organizations that helps us to kind of push our fellow Austrians in one direction or another? For example, you know, much as I admire and Israel Kirzner as a scholar, and much as I respect his contributions to Austrian economics and the theory of entrepreneurship in particular, I think one possible, harmful side effect of the popularity of the Kirznerian approach to the entrepreneur is that it has directed Austrians' attention away from the firm. So Austrian economists don't look, you know, have not looked in the recent past so much on the firm, on the capitalist, on business, on higher management, and so on, because they've tended to see entrepreneurship as something very, very different from capitalism, from capital ownership, from resource ownership. And I think that while Austrian theorists and applied Austrian economists have done great work on the business cycle, on the theory of the business cycle, and trying to understand, for example, the malinvestment that credit expansion tends to bring about and its consequences for economic activity, they haven't looked as much at sort of the microeconomics of the business cycle. How does credit expansion affect the ability of entrepreneurs to engage in economic calculation? The ability of business owners to, you know, effectively acquire and combine and redeploy factors of production to satisfy consumer wants. Because that hasn't been associated with entrepreneurship. That's sort of business people. Entrepreneurship is this very, very high-level thing about alertness and arbitrage and so on. So I think maybe we can push our fellow Austrians to think a little bit more deeply about the causal realist kind of blue-collar aspects of entrepreneurship and how they might be incorporated into all aspects of research in Austrian economics, right? We can also try to encourage mainstream economists and mainstream management scholars to study the Austrians. And I have to tell you, I have been surprised how successful we've been. I don't mean me personally, but how successful, Austrians have been in opening the eyes of some mainstream scholars to these kinds of truths. Now, it is still the case that within mainstream economics, Austrian economics is very much in the minority. It's sort of an out-of-the-mainstream, heterodox approach. If you go to the American Economic Association annual meeting, there's very little discussion of Austrian themes. There are other conferences, right? There's the Austrian Scholars Conference every spring in Auburn. There are the SDAE, Society for the Development of Austrian Economics, sessions at the Southern Economics Association annual meeting every fall. And at these meetings, there are Austrian presentations and Austrian discussions and so on. But these are not part of sort of the mainstream of economic theory. In the management field, I think Austrian economics has actually done much better. When I go to the annual meetings of the Academy of Management, I'm actually leaving on Thursday of this week for this year's meeting. They tend to have that's the largest mainstream meeting within management. There tend to be quite a few Austrian sessions and a lot of Austrian papers, particularly within the entrepreneurship subdivision, but within other divisions as well. To some degree, that reflects the fact that the academic management academic management field is a lot more diverse than the academic economics profession, right? Mainstream economics is very, very mainstream. There is an official paradigm, the neoclassical paradigm, and it's very tightly adhered to. Business administration, fields like strategy and entrepreneurship within management, that's much more eclectic, it's much more open. There isn't really a reigning paradigm in the same sense. And so Austrian ideas tend to get a much stronger hearing. That's one thing for all of us to think about. To the extent that these ideas have been useful, how can we make them better? How can we refine them, expand them, and where can we apply them? Can we apply them to other areas within Austrian economics? And can we apply them to mainstream stuff in management and in entrepreneurship? What about implications for practice? Now, I know that many of you in the course are, in fact, adult professionals who either run your own businesses or work for other companies, who have been involved, in many different aspects of economic organization, students who themselves are capitalist entrepreneurs, who themselves are promoters in Mises' sense of that term. And, I certainly hope that the ideas we've been discussing have been useful to you as well, not just to satisfy your intellectual curiosity, but also to help you in your day-to-day business affairs. Now, I say that with a caveat, right? A very important caveat is noted on the screen, that there is a difference between an economist and an entrepreneur. Even a brilliant Austrian economist who studies entrepreneurship, no matter how dashingly handsome, witty, and clever he might be, is not an entrepreneur, or at least is not necessarily an entrepreneur. So I don't think that economists have a rule book or a recipe book that they can hand to real-world capitalist entrepreneurs and say, read this, and you'll double your net income in a year. I actually have a business. I actually do that on the side, but that's my, $10,000 a year newsletter, which you'd have to subscribe to get all that good stuff. But seriously, what I mean is, I think thinking about these issues, studying these things, is useful for practicing entrepreneurs, but it isn't a substitute for judgment right? You can't teach someone how to be an entrepreneur, as Mises repeatedly emphasized, but we can think about entrepreneurship. We can theorize about it. We can look for its footprints in history and hopefully gain some insight that will be useful for practitioners. You know, for example, in looking at organizational design. So I hope that some of the things we've discussed in terms of the assignment of decision rights, appropriate use of appropriate incentive schemes, techniques for monitoring and governance, you know, those are very useful to practicing capitalist entrepreneurs, right, who may be very familiar with these things already, who may have stumbled upon them intuitively, but, you know, thinking about them in a more systematic sort of academic way can be very useful, okay? What about implications for policy? Well, we talked about these last week and had a good time doing it. I certainly think that attention to the issues that we've discussed all semester are extremely valuable to policymakers, mostly to tell them to quit screwing things up, okay? More specifically, subsidies for businesses or business people of various types. Bailouts for businesses that have gone bust. I mean, I'm probably preaching to the choir here, right? A lot of us think, well, that's silly, that's stupid, that's unfair, blah, blah, blah. But we can see, you know, it's harmful in even a more fundamental way, right? That the market economy is all about using resources, productive resources, to satisfy the desires, the wants, the goals of consumers. And in a free market, capitalist entrepreneurs have very strong incentives to do this, right? In their decisions to purchase factors, to sell factors, to combine factors, to think of new ways to get final goods out of particular factors, to come up with new final goods, new production methods, new processes, new markets, new marketing strategies, and so on. The desire to earn profit, right, in the Knightian sense of profit, and to avoid loss, is a very powerful motivator that sets up very strong incentives for capitalist entrepreneurs to use their resources appropriately, to be wise stewards of the goods and services under their control, right? In an economy in which if you blow it, you get a check. If you don't quite make it, the taxpayers will bail you out, right? That obviously changes the incentive structure for the capitalist entrepreneur, right? On the one hand, it encourages imprudent behavior, taking on excessive risk, you know, excessive leverage. And we can think of all kinds of behaviors that are highly inappropriate, that squander resources, and so on. But the incentives to avoid those are weakened when you know you'll get bailed out, right? There are other specific behaviors, lobbying for greater bailouts, trying to work the political system in one way or another to get what you want, right? These are obvious ways in which subsidies and bailout programs and so on encourage exactly the wrong kind of behavior, right? What about entrepreneurship programs? What about government programs, you know, Small Business Administration in the U.S., small business development corporations in various states? What about universities? I mean, my own university has several programs designed to teach entrepreneurship to students, to nurture budding entrepreneurs, by which they mean self-employed business people, right? I mean, my university has a taxpayer-funded incubator. That's a life sciences incubator that offers office space and, you know, technical consulting and support for people in the life sciences field wishing to start their own companies. But look, I think it's great for people in the life sciences field to start companies. And I think promoting research, promoting business development in general is a fine thing to do, but I think it should be done through the market. I think it should be up to private decision makers, whether they are philanthropists or investors, to provide the resources necessary to encourage research and, you know, startups in life sciences or any other field. It's not at all clear to me that government officials, that university officials spending the taxpayers' dime, have the appropriate incentives to direct these kinds of resources to their highest value uses. I've been thinking a lot about teaching programs. You could say, well, this whole course has been about teaching entrepreneurship. Yeah, but not in the way that it's typically taught in a college entrepreneurship course, which consists of, you know, personality tests. Do you have what it takes to be an entrepreneur, i.e. self-employed person, or not? Right? Teaching people how to write business plans, training students to be very smooth in giving their elevator pitches to venture capitalists. I mean, obviously, I'm not opposed to any of those things, but you know, that's really not what entrepreneurship is all about. Okay, that's not what it means. When Mises says entrepreneurship cannot be taught, he doesn't mean that kind of stuff. I mean, you can do all those things. Maybe it's valuable, maybe it isn't. But that isn't teaching an individual how to exercise judgment, or for that matter, how to exercise alertness or creativity or innovation or whatever. You know, I'm personally skeptical about a lot of college and university entrepreneurship programs. I think there's a bubble. I think a lot of resources are going into those, and at some point, someone's going to wake up and start smelling the roses, and whoever funds these programs and chairs and centers and institutes, and et cetera, is going to realize they're not getting very much for their money, and maybe they're going to pull the plug. Maybe this bubble will burst, and there will be a big shakeout period. Of course, I personally hope to survive it. But I imagine that many others will not, and maybe what will remain is a much sort of leaner, meaner, and yet more efficient kind of entrepreneurship educational, you know, setup. But that's something that remains to be seen. Okay, but I certainly have enjoyed teaching you guys, and I want to thank all of you for a great course. I've really had a great time preparing the lectures, delivering the lectures. I've enjoyed all of the discussions in the chat windows during lectures and office hours. I think the forums have been great, and I hope that even after this course is officially over, you'll keep reading the forums and keep participating in the forums. But I want to thank each and every one of you for participating. I especially want to thank Grayson and Dan, our TAs, who have provided excellent technical support. Guys, I could not have done it without you. And I look forward to working with all of you, seeing all of you again, either in person or on the web. Maybe for another course, maybe for an extension of this course, maybe for something entirely different. And I would encourage those of you, if you've never been to a Mises Institute program or a Mises Institute conference, I would strongly urge you to consider that, coming to Mises University in the summer, or one of the more advanced courses like the Rothbard Graduate Seminar, maybe coming to one of the smaller day-long weekend programs, the Mises Circles, coming to the Mises Institute Supporter Summit, which is usually in the fall. There's any number of great activities and programs out there. I hope you'll take advantage of them, and I hope that those of you who I've not met in person, I'll have a chance to meet in person really soon. So that's all I wanted to do in the way of lecture, you know, formal lecture. I want to stay here on the line until 6:30. Get a chance for some open discussion, for some Q&A time. Let me see what I've missed in the chat window while I was lecturing. Dan asked about social entrepreneurship. Yeah, we didn't talk about it a lot. We talked a little bit about policy entrepreneurship and political entrepreneurship. I mentioned that in the lecture. You know, we could maybe do some follow-up on social enterprise. Guys, I'm just going to stop the screen sharing for just a second, because it actually slows down my computer just a little bit. Now I've lost the little button that lets me do it. Let's see. Stop computer screen. Here we go. Okay. So I agree with the discussion up here, guys, about possible problems with the concept of social as applied to something like entrepreneurship. I haven't seen the thing about Singapore. I'll take a look at that. Thank you. Abalash, are you saying that I pronounced your name perfectly? I mean, that was my best attempt, at doing a phonetic reading. But I'm delighted that I got it right. And if there's anybody else in the course, by the way, whose name I have butchered, I want want to apologize for that right away. I hope that we'll have an opportunity, Grayson and Dan, maybe, you know, the technology may not be quite there to have these kinds of things where everybody's on video or audio. We have a real, you know, sort of, well, I hate the word webinar, but a real webinar kind of thing where we can all see each other and hear each other. That would be great. You guys are probably tired of seeing and hearing only me. Would like to get to meet some of your colleagues here. Let's see. Yes, Robert, it was great meeting you at Freedom Fest. That's a fun conference, too. It's usually in the summer out in Vegas. Some of you may enjoy doing that. Bella, where are you located physically? Oh, in Germany. Well, rumor has it, Bella, that there may be some kind of a Mises Institute conference, maybe somewhere in your area in the near future. As some of you know, the Mises Institute last fall 2009, held its annual fall supporters conference in Salamanca, Spain, which was absolutely fabulous. If you ever have a chance to visit Salamanca, I would strongly urge you to do so. The supporter summit this year will be in the U.S. It'll be in Auburn at the Mises Institute's facility. But I'm pushing hard to go someplace interesting next year. Maybe France, maybe Italy, maybe Austria. Gee, Austria would be an interesting place to have a conference on Austrian economics, wouldn't it? but anyway, so those of you in Europe, I hope we'll get to have some event for you over there. And I go to Europe usually several times a year for conferences and seminars, and lectures or whatever, so maybe I'll get a chance to bump into you guys there. Abhilash, yes, there is going to be a final exam. And I mentioned this at the very beginning of the discussion today. I think you might have come in just a minute or two late. It will be similar in format and content and delivery to the midterm exam. It'll be something like the midterm exam, with some questions that are focused mainly on material we discussed after the midterm exam, and also maybe one or two questions that I'll give you a chance to kind of put everything together from the start of the course to the end. But don't panic. You'll have some choice. I haven't finished writing it, but either you'll answer 4 out of 6 or any 5 out of 8 or something like that, so you'll have some choice on it as well. Hopefully it'll be ready sometime late this week, maybe this weekend, or at the latest, the start of next week, and you'll have several days to take it, just like you did with the midterm. After that, as soon as possible, I'll have final grades ready for you guys to review, and Grayson, I'm not exactly sure what, I know that you can get some official certification of the fact that you completed the course, but I'm not sure exactly how that works. Okay, Bella has a quick comment and a question. Okay, if you remember the lectures on the causal realist approach you gave in June 2007, I certainly do. I found the videos of those lectures on a YouTube account, and in my opinion, it is easily the best introductory course to Austrian economics that I've seen so far. I like that. I like that thought. I agree with you completely. the videos only have about 100 views each. They're hidden among the others. There might be another place. I know they're on the Mises YouTube channel as well, and I know they're also linked on Mises.org. They may have more views if you take all of those things into consideration. But, my philosophy is the world can never have too much Klein. Well, and also Salerno, who was the other teacher for that. So I'd be all in favor of opportunities to get that material out. So Bella, you're saying, could we do an academy course on this? I would be delighted to do that. Maybe Joe Salerno would want to do it as well, and he and I could do it as kind of a tag team. It's interesting, the way that course was designed is, I mean, it was set up so that people who have never studied economics before or had never studied Austrian economics, could take that course, but yet, you know, by the end, it had really worked up to some advanced concepts in economic theory in what Joe and I call the causal realist approach, the Mengerian Rothbardian approach to economics. I think it'd be great to offer a course like that As some of you know, Bob Murphy is doing a course that is either about to start or maybe it's already started on sort of introduction, very introductory economics, basic principles of economics for the newbie. And I think that Joe and I could do our course as kind of a follow-on to that, maybe an intermediate to advanced level course on economic theory that would follow Bob's introductory course. Grayson and Dan, I hope one of you is keeping track of all these suggestions, because I would love to do something like that. Yeah, I don't know when I'm coming to California next. I hope it'll be soon. I spent some very, very happy years in the San Francisco area when I was a grad student. And, the Mises Institute had an office out there in those days, and it was really great. In fact, you know, I get lots of I'll see people on, you know, Facebook or email, whatever, sometimes saying, "Hey, I'm going out to San Francisco for the weekend. Anybody got any good restaurant suggestions?" And I'm thinking, "Oh my gosh, how much time do you have?" I mean, San Francisco is the best foodie town, certainly one of the best foodie towns in the world. I don't know if it's better than Paris or better than Barcelona or some of the others that get all the press nowadays, but ooh. Dan, you figure out a way for me to get out there so we can go hang out at some restaurants. I'm all for that. Okay, yeah, Bella, they're not in the Mises YouTube channel. Grayson, would you mind pinging Jeff or Dan, one of you guys, would you ask Jeff if there's a way, or if you guys know a way to get those on the Mises YouTube channel? Grayson's asking, West Coast Mises. Well, Robert, what it was is, no, it's not exactly that. The Center for Libertarian Studies is a separate entity. This is kind of off, getting a little off topic, what the heck. The Mises Institute was founded in 1982, and at that time, it had three separate offices. There was, the administrative office was in Burlingame, California, which is just almost adjacent to the San Francisco airport. The academic office was in Auburn, Alabama, and there was a policy office in Washington, D.C. So Lou Rockwell and some of the other staff were located in California in those days. Again, this is when the Mises Institute was founded. Some of you are familiar with the Center for Libertarian Studies, which was headed by the late Bert Blumert, the wonderful man who passed away last year. Actually, Bert's office was in the same building as the office where the Mises Institute had its administrative headquarters. And so I actually worked as an intern when I was a grad student in that California office, again, interning for the Mises Institute, but I would also hang out with Bert Blumert and his staff at the Center for Libertarian Studies, and that was really great. Sometime in the mid to late 80s, it made more sense from the point of view of stewardship to consolidate all of the Mises Institute offices. So they were all brought to Auburn. So Jeff Tucker, for example, was running the Mises Institute policy office in D.C., and Jeff and his family moved to Auburn, and Lou Rockwell and his associates moved to Auburn as well. And now there's a beautiful facility just across from Auburn University, which houses the Institute. But in the early days, the Mises Institute rented some space from Auburn University, and actually the first Mises Institute space was in a little tiny building right next to the football stadium. It was basically an equipment shed that had been converted into a couple of work rooms. It was really pretty unimpressive, but that morphed into the beautiful facility that we have today. Let's see. Oh yeah, that's right. I remember, Dan. You were at the Newport Beach conference, and I've been looking for that book on eBay to make sure you didn't do anything with it. Actually, I was at the Mises Institute, Mises University this past week, and I've never been asked to sign so many things. And I don't think it was me personally. I mean, a lot of students bought a copy of my book and asked me to autograph it. But lots and lots of students were trying to get all of the speakers to autograph a copy of Mises' Human Action or Rothbard's Man, Economy, and State. So I got to see everybody's signature, and I got to tell you, I hope some of these students are taking their signed copies to a professional handwriting analyst, because I think some of those Mises Institute speakers had some real psychological issues. One kid actually had a guitar. He had an acoustic guitar and was asking all of the Mises Institute speakers to sign his guitar with a Sharpie, which I happily did. I did not have any requests from young female students to sign body parts, but maybe that'll happen at the next conference. Oh, Francesco, I'd love to hear about this book that you're doing on the entrepreneurship. That'd be fantastic. And, you know, it goes without saying, all of you students in this course, I hope that you'll keep in touch. I hope that you'll keep in touch with me by email and, you know, whatever. Let me know if I'd love to see articles that you're writing or theses or dissertations you're working on, essays, books, programs you're organizing, anything at all that you're doing in this area, I would love to know about, just to keep up with you and, of course, to keep up with the literature as well. Let's see. Yeah, there are a lot of, there are a lot of Austrians and a lot of Austrian activities in Europe. Yeah, Francisco's right. Unfortunately, not a lot in Italy, which is kind of ironic because Francesco, or do you pronounce it Francesco? There were very important Austrian-style economists working in Italy in the late 19th, early 20th century. Yeah, Leone, of course. But there were quite a few very important Austrians. Well, Francesco, you can tell us who they were. Excuse me. But there are a lot of Austrians in Spain. Juan Carlos, King Juan Carlos University in Madrid. That's where Jesus Huerta de Soto teaches. There's quite a lot of, there's many Austrians there. Surprisingly, maybe it's not surprising, but in Europe, the countries with the most Austrians are, I haven't counted, but there are a lot of Austrians, a lot of Austrian activity in Poland, in the Czech Republic, in some of the former Soviet republics. Just at the Mises University this past week, there was a huge contingent of advanced graduate students from Poland. A lot of them won various awards for their outstanding academic performance. Several of them were in residence as summer fellows. They're really outstanding. And, you know, I suspect that what's going on is in countries like in Eastern Europe and in the former Soviet Union that really experienced the absence of the capitalist entrepreneur, you know, are the ones that are most receptive to it, right? Sort of, you know, spoiled, Western, namby-pamby, left-liberal types who think socialism is great, and, you know, they hate the market because it's barbaric, and it's unfair, and it's not equal, and the market doesn't produce the right quality of music and art and so on. You know, it's like, okay, fine. If you had grown up in, Czechoslovakia in the 1950s and 60s, I bet you'd have a different view. I bet you'd be a heck of a lot more sympathetic. You know, it's kind of the Nirvana fallacy that we've talked about before. It's assuming that the other side of the grass is greener without really knowing much about it. But anyway, places that have experienced central planning firsthand have tended to be very receptive to Austrian ideas. I should mention France, of course. Guido Hulsmann in Angers is teaching in Angers. There are quite a few Austrians in Paris and elsewhere in France, so many other places that you guys should probably go. In fact, I think we should somehow raise funds to do a entrepreneurship in the capitalist economy party for everyone in the class. You know, my regular courses here at Missouri, sometimes at the end of the semester, and have the students over to my house, you know, for beer and hot dogs or something like that, a wine and cheese. I think that we should have some kind of an after-class party. And I think that Bella or Francesco or one of our colleagues located in an exciting and exotic place, maybe Dan out in San Francisco, should host it And I'm sure the host would be happy to raise the funds to fly everybody out and put us all up in a nice hotel and give us good food. Okay. What else, guys? Any other, you know, I don't know if you had a chance in preparing for a class today to go back and look over any old notes or old slides or old readings. Is there anything that's really on your mind? Anything that's, you know, that you wanted to know about this semester that we never got to? Are there any holes in your education about this field? Topics that you wish you knew more about? Wish we'd spent more time on? Or are there some issues or concepts or readings that, looking back on it, you're not sure you really got? Things I said that didn't make sense or were unclear? Parts of any of the readings, you know, that you didn't totally get? Now's a good time to speak up. Okay, Jim's got a question regarding measurement. I'm doing an applied project comparing entrepreneur-friendly conditions across states. It's a composite index that incorporates economic, policy, and demographic components. What kinds of variables would you suggest be included? That's a terrific question. Actually, one answer that I can give, if you'll forgive me, is to direct you to one of my own papers. Hold on just a second. Let me pull up the link here. Jim, check out this link. This is a link to a recently published article of mine with one of my former PhD students. This is an essay that came out of his doctoral dissertation, and he and I worked on it together to convert it into an article. And we did a statistical econometric study that, you know, at first glance, you might think, well, this violates all of the strictures that I gave you earlier about, you know, not looking for your keys under the lamppost and so on. Well, we fully recognize that, with the limit that, you know, that entrepreneurship itself is not something that can be observed or measured. You say, well, what if you construct a kind of composite index of some of these observable manifestations of entrepreneurship, like startups and VC and patents and self-employment rates and so on, and then looked at environmental conditions that would make be conducive to entrepreneurship. The most important is, I think, the Economic Freedom Index. Right? Let me see if I can scroll down this paper, see if I can find an appendix that lists some of these variables that would be useful. Let's see. I'm looking at table... Sorry, I don't remember my own paper here. Let's see. It's not table 2. Well, sorry, I can't find the right spot in the paper. But, let's see. Sorry, who am I talking to? Jim. Oh, yeah, sorry, Jim. We looked at the economic freedom scores, we looked at some individual components of the economic freedom index, security of property rights, you know, how onerous is government regulation and so on. You know, problem with that is those numbers don't really vary a whole lot within countries. So if you look at, you know, an analysis of all 50 U.S. states, The economic freedom scores are, you know, they don't vary a whole lot from between, you know, Alabama and Georgia and Michigan and whatever. You can also look at, you know, state fiscal conditions do vary, tax rates and so on. But we also looked at things like things that are not necessarily government policy, but, you know, the presence of research universities, that are active in particular set whatever industry you're interested in, you know, other large entities that are what are sometimes called anchor firms. So, you know, obvious example, Silicon Valley in the 60s, 70s, 80s, you had firms like Fairchild Semiconductor and then Hewlett Packard that were attracting a lot of scientists and engineers who would maybe spawn off new ventures after having worked at Fairchild or HP for a while, you know, Stanford University being there as well. So, Jim, take a look at that, the paper that I linked there, and see if you find anything there that would be useful to you. Hopefully you will. Ed is asking about Baumol's book. Well, it just so happens I have a copy of it right here. I did read it in manuscript form. In fact, if you look on the back, you can see there are some celebrity endorsements, like, look right there. You know, that's one of these superstars who, you know, sometimes they're people who haven't read the book or don't know anything about it, and they're just selling their name. I didn't sell my name, or at least they didn't pay me anything, but no, I did read some of the chapter drafts and offer some suggestions to the author and to the editors. I think there's a lot of good stuff in the book, but it's very different from the kind of thing that we're doing here. First of all, Baumol looks at, he defines entrepreneurship more narrowly than we are in this course. You know, he's really a Schumpeterian scholar and is really emphasizing innovation. Now, to his credit, he's trying to take the neoclassical innovation literature and expand it and broaden it somewhat. But he's not really thinking about the entrepreneur, the capitalist entrepreneur, in the same sense that we are in this course. Let's see, what's the other question? Yeah, is he trying to develop a neoclassical model of entrepreneurship? Yeah, I think so. I definitely think so. I mean, now, from Baumol's perspective, he's really on the fringes and is kind of really pushing the neoclassical paradigm and maybe, in his mind, going beyond it. You know, not really just neoclassical stuff, but I mean, look, but you know, to an Austrian, the book is pretty neoclassical. But to a neoclassical economist, you know, it might be pretty avant-garde, okay? Yeah, it looks pretty good. Okay, let's see. Yeah, Robert has a link. There are a number of different attempts to measure, you know, the quality of the business environment. Economic freedom, someone mentioned here, the amount of time necessary to start a firm. I mean, that was one of the main arguments in the famous book by a different De Soto, Hernando De Soto, the Peruvian economist, who wrote his breakthrough book was called The Other Path, published sometime in the 80s, I think, or late 80s, early 90s, on economic development in Latin America. And, you know, he pointed out that in Peru, it was something like, you know, given the number of forms that you have to fill out to start a new business in Peru, the amount of money you have to pay in bribes to get the permits and so on, it ends up using, you know, 250, the equivalent of 250 work days plus, you know, $10,000 or something like that. It's basically prohibitive for all but a very, very small number of people to set up businesses in Peru. Anyway, so probably since De Soto, a lot of people have begun collecting data on exactly this. How hard is it to start a firm, to run a business? Now, again, I'm mostly familiar with the indexes that try to measure that across countries, particularly in developing countries, not so much like among the U.S. states within the U.S. or among EU countries within the EU. Actually, but hold on a second. There's some people at the World Bank who do this. Right, it's called the Doing Business Group. I'm about to post a link for you guys here. Doingbusiness.org. That's a group at the World Bank that they have some indexes. They have rankings, how easy it is to do business in various countries. Actually, if you go to that website I just pointed to and click on rankings, you can see they have an overall ease of doing business rank, and it has to do with starting a business, getting permits, registering property, and so on. Singapore ranks number one. U.S. is not too bad at four. You know, just for fun, if you get into the very bottom, Central African Republic comes in at the very bottom. Most African countries are pretty low. European countries do quite well. Anyway, so that's something that you guys might want to take a look at. Yeah, Jim, I'm sure that cultural attitudes are important. But you're right, exactly how you would come up with, how you get a meaningful sense of that is hard to tell. Also, it's very easy to engage in kind of ex post facto reasoning, right? So because a particular community or state or region, you know, has a lot of entrepreneurial activity as conventionally measured, and has a particular culture, people tend to attribute it to that culture, right? I mean, I think partly this is, some of you may know this guy named Richard Florida, author of a very popular book called The Creative Class. He has his own Creative Class website, writes a lot on Creative Class stuff. You know, his thesis is that cities that are more diverse ethnically, culturally, have a more diverse industrial base, are more creative, you know, have more artists per capita and that sort of thing, tend to be more economically prosperous and tend to generate more economic, you know, entrepreneurship in the economic sense. But some of his critics have argued that, again, this is kind of an ex post thing, that it's true that a lot of entrepreneurial activity comes out of cities. And it's true that cities have more gay bars than, you know, some little town in Nebraska, but it doesn't follow that cities are more entrepreneurial because of exactly that. By the way, if you're using the World Bank Doing Business Indicators, they have some critics too. There's actually a guy that was a guest blogger at my website for a while. He's in Spain, or he's in Catalonia, a guy named Benito Arunada, who is actually quite critical of doing business rankings. I'm going to find a link for you here. Yeah, here's one of his things. Well, I'll tell you what, here's a link for you. If you're interested in the doing business stuff, you might want to take a look at some of the articles on this link. Let's see. Abolash, you're right. De Soto is the same guy who wrote The Mystery of Capital. No, he's not exactly Austrian, but you know, he says a lot of good things about property rights. I just actually heard someone, I can't remember who, say this past week at Mises University that they thought The Other Path was a really great book, that The Mystery of Capital was not quite as good or was more of a mixed bag. But he's a very important guy, definitely someone good to look at, especially if you're interested in sort of property rights issues. Yes, sampling on the dependent variable, Jim, would be one word for it. Another example, Dean's example is a good one. You know, another one about culture, though, is where I live in the Midwest. The Midwest has a lot of a particular form of economic organization. The cooperative form, particularly in agriculture, but in other areas too, cooperative banks, and cooperative real estate companies, cooperative insurance companies, you know, particularly in the upper Midwest, in Minnesota, Wisconsin, the Dakotas, Iowa, those are kind of the cooperative, you know, capitals of the U.S. And it's, even if you control for the amount of agricultural activity, it's not just that those are agricultural states. That even compared to other agricultural states, they have a lot of co-ops. One thing you often hear is a cultural explanation that these parts of the U.S., the upper Midwest, was settled mostly by Germans and Scandinavians, Lutherans, in other words. And the argument is there's something about kind of the Scandinavian culture and German Lutheran culture that encouraged more cooperation. The weather conditions were difficult. The winters were harsh. The land was actually not very good. I've interviewed people in that area for research projects who say, well, our ancestors had to cooperate to drain the swamps of Minnesota and Wisconsin and to make the land fertile. And therefore, they learned to cooperate, and that was incorporated into their culture, was passed down to their descendants, and that's why those areas are more cooperative than other parts of the U.S. I'm not sure I totally buy it, partly for reasons of sampling on the dependent variable, but other reasons as well. It's very hard to document the role that, you can have a variable like percent Lutheran in some, by county or by state, and try to use that as an explanatory variable in some kind of statistical analysis. But prior attempts to do so have not been particularly successful. There are studies of economic development looking across different countries that do look at religion and other aspects of culture, language, the percent Catholic and so on, as ways to try to capture the influence of cultural variables on economic activity. But it's very hard to do. I mean, if you're interested, send me an email, and I'd be happy to supply some additional references on some of these works that look at the impact of culture. But I'm not aware offhand of any that compared U.S. states just looking, you know, just looking within the U.S. I guess they figure our culture doesn't differ that much. Then again, you know, for people who are 25 and under, pretty much anywhere in the world, culture is fairly homogenous. They all say like and dude and I'm all this and he's all that, and they all dress pretty much the same and watch pretty much the same TV shows and listen to pretty much the same bands. I suspect if you went into deepest, darkest, Papua New Guinea, you might be able to find an isolated tribe somewhere that doesn't have MTV or they don't have access to iTunes, but I think it'd be hard. Dean, there's actually an interesting article by Mises that's in his collection called Money, Method, and the Market Process, where it's an article where he's fairly critical. It's an article by cooperatives. He's really talking about government, quasi-government-sponsored cooperatives. But one of the points he makes is he doesn't like the use of the term cooperative to refer to what we, a couple weeks ago, said, you know, more properly might be called patron-owned firms. So I prefer the term patron-owned firms, terms patron-owned firms and investor-owned firms, not co-ops versus corporations or something. Because, as Mises pointed out, it makes it sound like other kinds of, other legal forms of organization, you know, are not cooperative, that members of a corporation don't cooperate with each other, that people within a partnership don't cooperate with each other, that people on the market don't cooperate with each other. Well, obviously that's silly, right? I mean, Henry Hazlitt's famous article, iPencil, we criticized it earlier for not talking as much about the entrepreneur, but clearly the message of iPencil is that people can cooperate at a great distance, people cooperate anonymously through market prices, and through the profit system and the profit and loss system and blah, blah, blah. You're all very familiar with that argument. And that was kind of one of Mises' gripes in the article that I'm talking about. He wants us to remember that the market is cooperative, right? If so, it would be, you know, it would be hard to say that, well, a culture that believes in cooperation more is likely to choose co-ops, patron-owned firms, rather than investor-owned firms, partnerships or proprietorships or limited liability companies. I mean, they're all cooperative too. Politicians cooperate too, that's right, but not necessarily in very good ways. Let's see, let me look over my, let me check my email, see if I'm missing anything. Give you guys a chance to type some more questions. As always, have a microphone and or webcam, and you want to join us by audio, I think you can click on the little icon next to your name, and you can have an opportunity to speak to us if you would like. By the way, I added some stuff there is a learning forum for last week with some, I put an article in there this morning that you might find interesting. So, okay, anything else? Anything else that's on your mind? Any other questions, comments, criticisms, praises, exhortations, general expressions of happiness or sadness? Oh, by the way, I see that Dan has a link to the Organizations and Markets Facebook group, and I'd love to have you join it. There's, you know, the Facebook groups allow you to have, you know, chat rooms, and you can exchange, you can post to it, and so on. It automatically takes all of the postings from the Organizations and Markets blog and puts them on there, imports them into the Facebook page as posts, but it allows you to do all the other things you can do on a Facebook group page too, so you might like that. Be delighted to have all of you guys on there. Okay, guys, anything else? Should we shut it down for tonight? Oh, no, wait, Dean's got a question. What characteristics do successful firms all share? Is that a trick question? I certainly don't have a good answer for that, except that their CEOs attended one of Peter Klein's classes. Maybe that's the answer to your question. Anyway, okay. Well, guys, why don't we go ahead and call this session to a close? I'll send an email later. I'm thinking now that rather than have our usual drop-in office hour period on Thursday, I'll just make myself available to answer any questions that you have on email or through private chat or whatever. And I'm going to be traveling on Thursday. It may be difficult for me to get in front of the webcam during our usual Thursday office hour time anyway. But I'll send out an email to confirm. But I think probably at this point, between now and the final exam, exact details of which will be announced soon, I'll just make myself available to answer any questions or address any comments or issues by email. Okay, guys? Again, thanks a lot for all of you guys being here. I've had a wonderful time, and I hope that we'll have a chance to do it again very soon. Bye-bye, guys.